Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Things Therapy. I'm your host, Lisa Tahir. I'm a licensed clinical social worker practicing as an intuitive psychotherapist. You can find me online through NOLATherapy.com. It's the abbreviation for New Orleans, Los Angeles Therapy. From there, you can book sessions online with me, either in person at my New Orleans or Los Angeles office location, via phone, Skype, or FaceTime. You can listen to archived episodes of this show and subscribe to this show via iTunes, Google Play, and YouTube. There are links at NOLA Therapy. And if you enjoy what you please become a patron and support this show through my campaign at patreon.com/Lisa Tahir. There's a link as well at NOLA Therapy with an introductory video. So today I'm going to bring on in just a few moments Dr. Melissa Richman. She is a doctor of psychology as well as a licensed clinical social worker. She's also a diplomat of the American Psychotherapy Association. And today we're going to talk about a lot of things. Most importantly, her perspective of practice, which her mission is about psychotherapy being a relationship. And she bears witness to her patient's narrative by creating emotional safety to help her patients achieve insight, build trust, and get to a place of psychological and emotional well-being, seeing the context of this relationship in terms of a corrective relational partner. Dr. Richman also had an internet-based radio show called Shrink Wrap in the past, which I'm going to ask her about, and is a contributor to E! True Hollywood Story. Welcome, Dr. Richman.
Thank you. Good to be on.
How are you today?
I am good. It's nice to have a break from my practice and to share this experience with you and talk to another therapist. Sometimes it gets kind of isolating in practicing 10 hours of patients a day.
And I think in private practice, especially where we're moving from one person to the next and in other stuff and taking some time out to check in with ourselves, I think is important.
Absolutely. I try to do that in between my hours, but this is really a pleasure, and I appreciate you asking me to be on.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure for me as well, and I'm curious, where would you like to start in talking about things today?
Well, I think we first should maybe recognize what's going on in the world and what just happened in Barcelona, and I know that that's at everybody's, you know, thought process today, and I know there's just more and more chaos happening. So I just want to speak to that, and maybe we want to kind of talk about that. I know it's certainly present for patients every day. Certainly those that are not fans of what's happening in our presidential, you know, office right now. And I know everybody's pretty preoccupied. It's quite a dysregulated time right now.
It is in a time of fear and uncertainty, and my clients are coming in feeling really just fearful in general and kind of like generalized anxiety and where do I fit and how do I maneuver in life. I wonder if you're having a similar experience in your work.
You know, it is. This moment is so big for people, and it kind of takes them out of the mundane stuff that sometimes people are working through and spend a lot of time talking about how unsafe people actually really feel right now. I certainly don't speak to it politically. You know, I think this was going on pre-Trump, but I think it's a much more kind of exacerbated time. It's a much more extreme time. It's a dysregulated time. I think there's incredible recklessness going on and carelessness, and I think people are just you know, incredibly porous, and they just feel unsafe. And, you know, at this time in our life in 2017, it's kind of remarkable that these are the conversations we're having, and that, you know, terrorism and people driving over each other is kind of the standard of practice right now. And it's kind of appalling, really. People have generalized anxiety. They have, you know, they're depressed. They feel frightened. And, you know, it's just another avenue to kind of put some of their deeper issues into a focus, you know, on the political world. I know with me, I sometimes watch the news way too much and I can't seem to turn it off.
Right. And I think the state of mind that people are in triggers from a sense of helplessness and confusion, a lot of anger, and that fight or flight kind of positioning. And so I think the angry component, it just makes things worse, because it's hard to sit back and respond instead of react, because of all the emotion going on around these events that are so horrific.
You know, we look to the president, I suppose, certainly, you know, as like what we do is a corrective relational partner, really, like in our world, to kind of create a foundation, a calm, a structure, you know, holding the highest office. And I think what's going on, certainly, is it triggers, you know, much, much bigger discussion, that people feel so angry that there's nobody there to make them feel safe. And, you know, on such a global stage, I think it's appropriate to feel the kind of anxiety everybody feels, that there's no kind of accountability and there's no rule of law. And I think for all of us, that if there are no boundaries and there is no rule of law and there is no structure, people feel completely out of control. And then it triggers the gamut of symptoms, you know, regardless of the real cause. This is a huge stressor that is making, you know, at least people that I see pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah, and when I think even of the perspective you work from, with psychotherapy being a relationship and our president representing in some terms kind of the parent of our country, and to see a president of our country act in ways and say things that are so jarring to our sense of well-being is destabilizing, just like growing up in our family of origins when a parent or role model did such a thing.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And I think the kind of defiance and, you know, what appears to be, I certainly don't know him, so I can't really speak to it, but there's a malignancy about this. And I think it as a parent, it's perpetuating a message that it's okay to, you know, act out. It's okay to be extreme. It's okay to not have a rule of law. And the disrespect and the entitlement is just, it's a big problem. Politico last night on the news talked about, it was an interesting saying, that, you know, Trump chooses fighting over healing. And, you know, obviously I think there's a lot more going on, you know, underneath, you know, his personality, but I'm not going to get into that.
Right.
It's really, I think, a really sad and scary time, and I hope somebody gets control of it.
Yeah.
But I think it gives us the opportunity to really focus on ourselves and realize that, you know, healthiness is a primary piece of being functional in the world.
Yes. And so I wonder if this might be a segue into your work, talking about the psychotherapy of authentic relationships and personality for adults.
Absolutely.
Can you share with our listeners some about this?
Sure. I mean, I'll talk about what I do and kind of how I think about therapy and kind of what I've developed. And, you know, so, you know, we know that when our patients come to us, they're presenting a problem, they report a symptom, you know, they generally share a feeling or a difficulty in their life and they're unhappy with. And, you know, rarely today, due to, you know, finances, due to insurance issues, due to all sorts of things, do we have patients just come to therapy to explore themselves and drop into a traditional psychotherapy. So we know that patients come to us with a problem, ultimately depending on the assessment and depending on all the factors. A psychotherapy begins. Patient wants to feel better. You know, many times patients have no idea really what psychotherapy is, but, you know, they ask a lot of questions. You know, why do I need to pay you to talk to you? I can talk with my friends. I can go online. I can, you know, I can chat. I can do all sorts of things. And I think that when they really understand what therapy is, it kind of facilitated me in developing a way to explain to patients, you know, how effective it truly is. So I see psychotherapy as another relationship, a microcosm in one's life. From the first point of contact, you know, a relationship starts to develop with our patients. And, you know, from that moment on, at least for me, the first time I speak to somebody on the phone and connect, there's a reparative, healing, corrective process that happens when they work with me. I think that in some ways, apropos to what we were just talking about, that we're a healing force. And, you know, we need to establish and embody all the values that a good and healthy relationship requires. So from the point of contact, you know, the ideas of respect, reliability, consistency, loyalty, communication, boundaries, positive regard, hope, compassion, and the agreements we set for a successful psychotherapy, it's a corrective relationship. A corrective process begins, and slowly we start to move deeper as the patient allows us and feels safer into the deep territories of their psyche. I believe, which more in the, you know, older days, it was a different kind of focus, that therapy, psychotherapy, is a mutually beneficial relationship, and it's the only way a solid relationship can develop. And essentially what goes on in a patient's life and their relationships out in the world is going to show up in the room with me. And if we fix it in the room, it tends to improve out in their world, meaning a microcosm. I have a belief system with patients that I can't do the work without them, and they can't do the work without me. So it sets the stage for this corrective reparative process. And that's how I developed the idea of a CRP, or a corrective relational partner. And, you know, however we're trained, all the years of schooling that we have, if we are not sitting in a position, aside from being qualified, we have to be really good at how we have relationships, because I think, like parenting, it sets the stage for any corrective process to happen. So that's kind of the essence of how I work. And once that's established, I kind of look at it as you know, a really safe kind of box. And I explain to patients there's lots of ways to get help nowadays, but I am a bit traditional, where I believe that it has to happen in the room. I know we do phone therapy now and all sorts of things, but I'm a bit rigid around that, because I think the traditional nature of a psychotherapy and why we meet in the office and why we do what we do, it's effective for a reason, and that's how it works. So, of course, I'm flexible in lots of ways, but I think that there's a true essence that has to happen for therapy to work.
Well, and I think for you, that's part of the boundaries that you create for in the environment and context that you're building and creating with your patients, is being in the room. And your perspective is one of being in the here and now and being in the moment and dealing with what is coming up, correct? Yeah. So it makes sense to you, I mean, that you want them in your room.
And I mean, I have a practice of about 45 hours of patients a week, all reserved patients, you know, and it's traditional in that sense. But I also have patients that are on the East Coast, that are in Europe. And so obviously we do more flexible things like phone and, you know, FaceTime and Skype when necessary, but I am somebody that believes that you need to see your patient live and really do the work, because there's so much that happens in the therapy office. But obviously it's a sign of the times, so we do what we have to do. But there's no option, so we have to be flexible. But I think as long as we maintain the frame and the ideas are understood, I think it's certainly been an incredible process. And so I think the corrective relationship is really the root of it all.
So in preparing to speak with you today, Dr. Richmond, I was tossing this idea around last night and as I went on a jog earlier and wanted to get your thoughts. And because in my work, I often see people getting kind of stuck in this unconscious process or shadow process where they are living between, say, this place from within themselves of the wounded child and, you know, being in the wounded child space, reacting from the position of their impulsive and angry adolescent. And I'm trying to help bring co-consciousness of the adult. Where's the adult here? To moderate, to parent, to love, and teaching my clients to really nourish and nurture that structure of a parent's ego state. And I wonder how, if you, when you see this, how you handle it and such, to talk to our listeners about the shadow and balancing our unconscious processes.
Well, I come from a self-psychology model, but I'll try to speak to it and how I understand it. I mean, I think that's the work, and I think in the corrective process, in the role you play, in the transference, you know, the impulses and the more kind of dysregulated parts of ourselves and that we see with patients, and then developing a much more kind of ego-focused, healthy adult, where I think there's a lot of dysregulation in people, and certainly now, is there's no kind of real sense of healthy separateness. And I think that certainly in our generation, we grew up very enmeshed with our parents and you know, not a lot of healthy separateness. So I kind of have a motto that we're working with healthy separateness and healthy connectedness. And we see a lot of addiction, obviously. We see a lot of extremes. And the work and why the process takes so long is the ability to tolerate discomfort and sit in the imbalance of these two states is really where the therapy exists of how one develops, I think, better executive functioning, a better ego strength, and starts to understand what they're really working with and what perhaps trauma is and why it's so hard to tolerate discomfort and not find a quick fix. And I think that that's why therapy is such an incredible process, because there are no quick fixes in life. And the answer to this is to learn to integrate these two states of mind. So it's very much like an addict, right? You have these extremes, and in order to function in the world, despite sobriety, you have to learn to become malleable and tolerate what's happening in your life and tolerate the states of mind that are working inside of us. And we can only do that through expression and through examining and learning to really understand all those parts of yourselves. And I think that's what you're doing and drawing out. But, you know, it's a very difficult, impatient process, because people want to feel better. And sometimes you just sit and it goes on and on and on and on. But I think that that's where the mirroring and the modeling and the role of a CRP, that, you know, you're certainly in the healing force, you know, that's where the work is, because there is no quick fix.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I like to hear you saying, speaking it and couching it in terms of healthy separation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we're either, you know, fearing kind of enmeshments on the one hand, you know, we have a loss of kind of identity and a loss of self. It's kind of like what's happening politically. Like, if you don't believe in his way, there is no way. And then he becomes defiant. And there's a lot of anxiety that people struggle with, that if I'm not enmeshed, or we do not have one thought process or one mind, then there's an abandonment, or there's a guilt, or there's a loss. And then the other extreme is, right. And then there's another extreme, that if I'm so separate and I'm so alone and I'm so apart from you, I'm going to stay self-protective and I'm not going to have any relationships and I'm going to isolate. And there's that. And those are both kind of, I believe, primitive states. And so healthy separateness and healthy connectedness all at the same time is an integration. And I think that that's ultimately where healthy personality develops. So that's why it takes forever to a therapy process. Some of my patients are with me 18 years.
I love that. Yeah, and that's not as common certain insurance changes. I've always loved doing the long-term work also, because you really get to see and facilitate a person's growth and change this from core wounding level onwards, I think.
And
the mastery.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel incredible gratitude. I have a practice, and I'm sure this is going to sound right, but I don't take insurance, and I never have, so I'm all fee-for-service based. So I always have been when I started 20 years ago. Obviously, it's grown from there, but prior, when I spent most of my training in hospitals and institutions, and I think I did foster care for a few years, but when I went into did managed care for a while, and then when I finally took the leap to go into private practice, I think I was defiant myself, and I thought, well, even if I make $2, I'm not going to take insurance. And I've kind of built this just really amazing business. And I think it's really only because of the relationships I have with patients and the way my practice works that I'm blessed with patients that, you know, come back and forth. And as I said, my longest patient is 18 years. My shortest patient right now, I think is a year. And, you know, it's really just based on the corrective experience and the attachment and the secure attachment that I think we're all looking for. And it allows for a balance in life.
I was just about to say that as I'm hearing you speak, I'm thinking of attachment styles, which has been a big part of my work and different things I've written and put out there is our attachment style, be it anxious, avoidant, mm-hmm. secure, mm-hmm. or a combination of those underlies, how we relate to ourselves, to money, to each other. Can you speak about that for our listeners?
Yeah, you know, attachment is everything. I think that's a you know, without getting theoretical, that's certainly the basis of my, you know, my process and what I just kind of spoke to about the corrective, you know, relationship process. It is all pretty much based on attachment theory. You know, the idea is we're all looking for some secure attachment and how to kind of heal anxious attachment and secure attachment and all of those things. Certainly not blaming parents or family. You know, parents have done the best that they can, and we have such an excessive environment, you know, right now, certainly with like millennials, that there is so much anxious attachment and you know, kind of, I like to say, overly secure attachment. And again, not a lot of balance and self-definition and individuation. And so I think developing, you know, that in the room and teaching people to understand what healthy attachment looks like and healthy love looks like and healthy functionality looks like, I think is the key. But we have to go into, you know, I always say to patients, we can't just topically treat this. We have to go into the pipes, you know, we have to snake the brain to get in there to understand what we're dealing with, and without pathologizing things. I mean, obviously when things are necessary to diagnose, we do that. But this is about an examination of self. I think that you can't really be successful in life until you really have the ability to think about yourself and understand oneself. And attachment style is absolutely the root of that. So for therapists, I think we are a healing force, and we have to exhibit secure attachment, and we have to be healthy enough in ourselves to not just be qualified. We have to sit in the room, and I always say we don't want to be a weapon to our patient. We want to create a healing environment and a sanctuary to do the deeper work, because it can be so painful.
Yes, and I also like that you're saying to our listeners in the, as kind of the reality that this work does take time. The spirit and genre, there's this kind of illusion that you can wave some Palo Santo or incense around you and be healed and be cured. And it's just really maddening to me to be around that kind of thought, because and I think it leads clients, patients to feel like failures when the up again, when the struggle comes back up again. So I think practitioners that work in that way are doing a disservice and actually hurting patients and clients, because it's setting them up to feel like they're not doing something right or they're resisting. Instead of a lot of the changes are people come to us for, it's taken their whole lives to develop these patterns and ways of being. It can very well take a lot of time to undo that and change and heal and to give a client and patient permission to be in that space as long as they need to be.
100%. I mean, the catharsis of it all, and, you know, where are we rushing to? And, you know, I think that shows up as intimacy stuff as well when we make those interpretations that, you know, why is this so painful? Why is this so frightening to spend time with yourself? What are we finding out about you that makes this so scary? And it's really an incredible discussion. I was just talking to a patient before you and I started talking, and she was saying, a young girl, she's, you know, give me the answers. How do I fix this? You know, what should I do when I'm on my vacation? And, you know, I was talking to a colleague of mine the other day who saw a patient of mine, and, you know, and the focus was on cognitive therapy, which, you know, I do some of, but I'm much more psychodynamic in nature because I believe that, again, you know, we have to look at attachment. We have to look at the deeper stuff, but CBT is absolutely 100% beneficial, but it's a topical, you know, fix. And, you know, and every time I work with that, you know, the patient will ultimately come back and go, this isn't working. It's not fixing how I feel. And I am one of those people in the gestalt of my work. I do all sorts of kinds of things, but I still believe that the relationship and the dynamic work is the only thing that allows for change, right? A corrective relationship is the only thing that allows for change. And I think we are burdened today, and this is to show no disrespect to the quick fixes we have today that people want. But ultimately, I think it always comes back to, I said yesterday to somebody that maybe my profession is going to be the only profession that really requires still a one-on-one experience in the room, you know, 20 years from now when we're all flying around. You know, and there is no quick fix to getting better. There's no quick fix when we're medically ill. You know, a wonderful colleague of mine that I work with, a psychiatrist, he talks about medication being 25% of the battle unless you have a significant Axis 1 diagnosis. And, you know, it's hard. Relationships are hard. Getting healthy is hard. Yeah. And, you know, I certainly in my own life, you know, have spent the good part of, I don't know, 35 years still in my own therapy. And not that I learn more theoretically, but I can't wait to get there every week because it's a place for me to continue to examine myself. And if you know me or any students of mine or anybody I've worked with, I'm a stickler about we can't just be qualified. We have to walk the walk. And
yes,
how could
Dr.
we...
Richmond.
Right? We have to walk the walk with our patients. So I'm very much about, you know, us doing our own work and tolerating the same process that everyone else is tolerating, you know?
Yes, I could not have said it better. And I'm of the same mind to be in my own therapeutic process, to be a top level practitioner and be aware of what's my stuff and separate that from my clients coming to me and just wanting to be a healthy, aware, evolved human being that's contributing good to this world. And I think it's a way to really clear up our emotional baggage, for lack of a better term, and just really create our lives from intention and purpose as opposed to defaulting old patterns of how we grew up, our predecessors, our culture, et cetera, and to really be a clear and authentic voice. I know you talk about authenticity in your work as well, which I like, that for us to be authentic human beings is important.
Well, I think it's the Brené Brown concept, right, who I absolutely admire and respect and love to work with is, you know, the idea of perfectionism. I think I have three copies of her book here, Guide to Imperfectionism, and the idea that our society has so much pressure and some of the ways in which we grew up that created anxious attachment is this idea of perfectionism, and there's no such thing. None of us are perfect. Therapy certainly isn't a perfect process, and we're all on this mad dash to fix everything, and it's a road going nowhere. And as we learn to kind of drop into the imperfectionism and the humanity of who we all are. I think we become healthier as a society, and we become healthier in our lives, and we become healthier in our relationships. And I think that that's the goal. So vulnerability, you know, all the stuff Brené talks about, you know, and how she talks about herself, and she's so organic or in real. I in the old days there was David Viscott. I don't know if you remember who he was.
No.
He did like a radio show on CBS okay. late at night when I was little, and I used to watch it. He was a psychiatrist, and he unfortunately passed away. But people used to call in, and he was so authentic, and he just answered so organically. And I think that's what patients need, too, is mm-hmm. to feel like they can, yes, you're sitting with these experts and, you know, we're trained, blah, blah, blah. But people want to feel, you know, like they're healing, that there's not shame in the room, and we're all just people doing the work to try to find a better way of feeling every day.
Yes, and that there's not judgment in the room. So
yeah.
So the person can really be their authentic self with us so that we can have that corrective relational yeah. experience. So the client, the patient can have that experience. It does take transparency and vulnerability.
That made me think about what you asked me a few minutes ago about the shadow and those yeah. two states. And I think that's where the, you know, the sense of imperfectionism and shame shows up with patients, is when they're sitting in that in-between state, and it's almost unbearable at times, which is where, you know, our job is to bear witness to that. And once we allow the expression and we bring it into the room, it integrates, and that shame decreases, and there's a much more kind of functionality to how they're operating in the world. So, you know, I think that is the process of therapy, and why it takes so much time. You know, in the olden days, we talked about peeling the onion. You know, we literally
yes,
are peeling
yes.
the onion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have so many defenses, and we're all just trying to be a little bit more malleable and flexible in the world.
Yes.
You know?
And, yeah, I do know. Did you have a thought? I don't want to interrupt you.
No. I was just listening to what you were saying. I was thinking about me trying to do yoga and how ridiculous it is. But you know, I'm stretching instead, because I'm a spin fanatic, and from sitting all day, 10 hours a day, I have a bad lower back, and I've been stretching took this like stretch class thing, and I've been doing these stretches at night, and I'm in so much agony trying to stretch that I realize this is not going to get fixed overnight. I'm going to have to continue to try to do yoga and stretch and do
yes.
all the things I don't want to do.
We have more in common than what I knew. I have been a spin instructor for 12 years for fun.
Oh no.
And experienced the tightness and lower back issues that I just heard you describe. And I became a yogi and spent about 2 years actively with a really just involved yoga practice. And now I just kind of work out for fun, whatever it is my body wants on a given day.
Yeah.
Today I thought I'd go running. My brain said go run, but my body
yeah.
wanted to walk. So it was more of a walk. I'm learning to listen and tune in to what my body wants instead of what I am telling it to do. So, yeah, and that's being flexible, like you were speaking about earlier, learning to
yeah.
be flexible, that your body's needs have changed as well, and you're stretching yourself, though you feel ridiculous or that you're not doing it well enough. But what a
mm-hmm.
beautiful metaphor for what you're teaching your patients and
absolutely
modeling.
My stuff, absolutely, that. You know, if I can't do it well, I don't really like to do it. So that's my journey that I'm working on. And certainly as it comes to yoga, trying to figure out how to look a little bit better at doing it. But it's torture for me, but I know it's good for me.
I feel you.
I'd much rather hang out in Soul Cycle.
Absolutely. Yeah. But this is good. I'm stretching yourself literally and metaphorically.
Yeah, for sure. So what, you know, we're all working the same struggle. We and if we can all kind of come into that, maybe it could ease up a lot of the pain and stress that we're all watching on the news and that we're all going through. Because, you know, there is no quick fix. And I always say on my hashtags, the real deal. You know, there just is no shortcut.
I like that. And speaking of your hashtag, can we talk about, because I've been reading it and following your new life rules.
That's important. Sure.
I don't want to miss that before we're done for our listeners to know and follow you on Twitter.
So, like 5 years ago, I think, I was, you know, in a part of my own journey, and I was going through a very difficult time, and I write a lot, but I started to, mm-hmm. to need to kind of consolidate and create in my brain, like, what am I trying to say? Like, what am I working on? What am I dealing with? And it really came out of a personal expression, and I started writing these. I was actually listening to Bill Maher, and he was doing his new rules. And then, I don't know, a few days later, I'm like, that's what I do. And I started writing these new life rules for myself, really. And then, trying to, be cool and be a part of social media, I started, I think it was around the time my website developed, I started having my IT guy put them on my Facebook and, kind of do all that. And I started to get the most unbelievable feedback from people all over the country and emailing me and, God, these have so much depth to them. And I try to write them from a relational standpoint. And I just kept doing it. I think I have like 500. I have, we're trying to get it to be a book. But I don't really have the time to do that. And I keep writing them, and I find relief in them, and I hope that people enjoy them. And sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're, I read them and I'm like, oh boy, that was not a good one. So it came out of, I'm like, wow, I must have written that, So I write them like every, I think I write them a few every couple months. Every once a month, I write them for the next month. But, I think they're just corrective and they're just fun. So, but it definitely came out of a time in my own life that was very difficult and very painful. My father was dying. And so that's how it started. So now it's a thing, and maybe it'll be more of a thing. I have no idea. I don't really have time other than to write the new rules. But sometimes I want to write cases and kind of tie it all in, but I suppose I will one day.
Absolutely. And for our listeners to know that your website is richmancare.com, richmancare.com. And on Twitter, you're under Dr. Maher. Is that correct?
Dr. Maher.
At Melissa Dr. Maher.
Yeah, hold on, I'm looking at Melissa Dr. Maher. That's how cool I really am. And then my Instagram is under my name, Dr. Melissa Richmond.
Well, I think what you've been doing for 5 years, who knows where it'll go. I had started on Twitter putting out today's thoughts about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and that's evolved into affirmations and mantras that I'm putting into a book on identifying core wounding through an aspect of our astrological charts. And so I hope the book to be out by 2019. So I'm trying to carve out time.
Wow,
so I know
wonderful.
This will happen for you. Thank you.
Congratulations.
And it's part of your self-care. Thank you. It's in process. So, but maybe for you even to, as part of your self-care, to formalize the 5 years of that's really deep that you've been doing this work, putting out your life rules, new life rules. Wow.
Yeah, maybe. That's wonderful.
Thank you. So while I'm speaking with you, so I don't often get to talk to someone that works with addictions and dual diagnosis disorders, meaning substance abuse and mental health issues. That's such an epidemic in our culture in the U.S. Addictions, whatever.
I do a lot of sex addiction primarily, though. But I of course, I work with
addiction. Okay. Well, talk to us about this. Yeah, I'd love to hear more.
Sex addiction is a big fancy word for a real problem in our world today. And, obviously the root, again, I think, of attachment and intimacy.
Attachment, absolutely. Yeah.
Same with, chemical dependency and mental health. I am not one of those therapists that believes that it's strictly about an addictive behavioral problem. I think there's always a psychological component to it, thus the dual dual nature. So I'm kind of now in my practice. I don't really see patients that are, you know, chronically using anymore. They're usually sober or they're in some version of recovery, ready to do the deeper work, you know, and get into, you know, the addiction issues and the underlying peace and family issues. So, you know, again, addiction for me is a big fancy word that embodies so much, and the topics of chemical dependency and sex, you know, obviously it's all interrelated to the deeper psychology of the person. But yes, I do a lot of that. I do a lot of couples work, which I'm really enjoying right now. And I see adults. I don't see children because my brain is much too complicated. you know, I would never put a child through that. My brain is firing too quickly. Pretty much, you know, addiction, sex addiction, intimacy, couples work. I do a lot of collaborative divorce. You know, the usual syndromes that are appropriate and safe for private practice. I don't really deal with acute crisis anymore. Once in a while, it happens. But our epidemic of addiction, my God, it's the opiate, you know, world and everything that.
Yeah.
You know, in the recovery world, there's a lot of, you know I've been hearing, I was meeting with a program last Friday, and, you know, the ethical issues, one of those things that are big for me is ethics and boundaries and you know, maintaining, you know, a standard of practice and a standard of care. And the mental health world and the recovery world has become so reckless as well. And not all programs. I work with some pretty amazing people. But, you know, I think that feeds kind of like our political world, that feeds the chaos that's going on and the epidemic. I think there's so much excess and there's such a lack of boundary and such a lack of containment nowadays that, you know, again, I think these programs are responsible for the kind of product and patient that they let walk out the door at the end of their treatment. And obviously patients responsible for their own work, but I think there's just such a mess going on. So I'm very much devoted to addiction and recovery and getting some kind of control of this disease. And hopefully I do that a little bit in my practice every day, but it's really scary, especially the opiate dilemma that we have.
It is. And when I think of addiction treatment and recovery, I think of it in terms of a relationship, which has been the theme of our time together today, that a person that's developed a primary relationship with a substance of choice. And I find that it helps my clients to destigmatize it, help them judge themselves a little less harshly, to see it as a primary relationship that brings them certain emotions. Yes. And so I don't do as much of that work as I used to either.
It's tough work, you know. Yeah. I mean, there's so much shame involved in it. And when a patient understands it's just a symptom, I have a belief system as well that, you know, in the way I was trained, symptoms protect us from what's really going on. I think a professor in my master's program spoke of this when in an addiction class that you know, addiction is a pseudo vitality, and it becomes the central organizing principle of one's life. And it's strictly a symptom, certainly the kind of substance, again, even sex or gambling or whatever, but it speaks to the issues at hand that we're treating psychologically. But you're absolutely right. And I like that you always talk about stigma and you talk about, you know, kind of creating that safe space as well. And, you know, when patients learn it is a symptom and there's all sorts of stuff going on underneath it, it becomes a much more flexible examination and flexible treatment, you know, and there's not such rigidity. And I do not believe that 12-step, I'm sure there's going to be drama from this comment, but I do not believe.
Where are you going? Yeah.
You know, that 12-step is the only thing that can treat addiction. And I actually think that that is reckless as well, that there is no way that a 12-step program can treat addiction, perhaps behaviorally. I think it's necessary. I think it's an incredible self-help program. But I absolutely am one of those psychotherapists that will scream at the top of my lungs that psychotherapy is the only way to go to really become healthy.
Yeah, and I practice from a harm reduction perspective.
Absolutely.
Viewing addiction as a relationship as opposed to a 12-step model that works for some people to keep them in abstinence. I don't know that it really helps them deal with the big underlying issues and components that are there, that certainly different for everyone.
It's a microcosm again, right? Because they're going to go to meetings and they're going to work their program and they're going to have the relationship with their sponsor and their sponsees and their commitments, and they're going to see their style of relating and their attachment stuff show up again. So it's just going to show up in that model as well. So, you know, wherever you go, there you are, right?
And so
the same stuff's going to show up. So it, you know, the world is built on relationships, or our relationship to everything is the root, you know, our relationship to how we take care of ourselves every day, the relationship to how we wake up in the morning, the relationship to how we deal with stress, the relationship to how we, you know, walk into a 12-step meeting. I think everything is about a relationship and
yes.
You know, that's all we have. So if that's not the most important thing, and then, you know, we deal with the source of that, which is ourselves, how could any of our relationships really be healthy? And you're right.
And I hear under...
Go ahead, sorry.
No, you first.
I was just saying that, you know, so if addiction is our only primary relationship, and we know that that's going to fail us, then we're going to be left again with having to deal with ourselves and deal with the underlying ways in which we have relationships and what our trauma is around that. And, you know, there is no quick fix. A substance is not going to fix this. There's just a long road to get to be healthy. So I think we have to hit it from all ends. And I think 12-step is phenomenal, but I do not think it's enough. And I do not think psychotherapy is enough if there's an addiction model. I think there absolutely needs to be a self-help program and people in recovery. But again, I think it's all about integration and balance and you know, and finding exactly what somebody needs, meditation, mindfulness, you know.
Yes. Other self-care practices.
Yeah, I think, you know, the way to be happy in life is to figure out, you know, what you really need to be happy, and that's the first order of business, to not feel shame about that and to go after what that is, to you know, this life is short, so to have everything that you need in life, I think, or a little version of that, I suppose, is the goal. But if you don't fix how you have relationships and treat that, I don't know how that happens.
Right.
So hopefully I can be that model of change in at least my small little bubble and you know, help the way I help every day. And learn as well for myself. So everything I do, I try to take with me and work on myself, because God knows what we do every day is incredibly challenging.
I hear you just really having unconditional positive regard and acceptance for your patients and in such a non-judgmental way, which is so important. So I just really see how you meet the people in your room with openness and with a desire to truly help and work with them. And it's really beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, yes, there's a lot of structure to what I do and a lot of boundaries to what I do, but I think it's like a fence around our house, that the environment has to be safe, and the only way to do that, I think, is with boundaries and with healing and with a lot of compassion and empathy. So yeah, I try to present that every day. And when I don't, I go to my own therapy and whine and complain.
The boundaries and ethics are important. And for me, I tend to be really accepting and not judgmental big struggle has been criticisms and judgments of other practitioners that don't have the necessary training or exposure to boundaries and ethics, because of what we do is so important, and it's such a calling to, with a lot of responsibility, people's lives and personalities and hearts in our hands. So I just urge any healing practitioner to please take the time to nurture your ethics, because what we do is so important in the world.
Absolutely. Any person in the healing, you know, world, and I think it's everywhere. You know, if somebody, you're working with somebody, not even in the health world or the mental health world, and they're not healthy, it's not going to be a positive experience.
Right.
But if we maintain healthy separateness, then it'll just make it a little bit easier.
It will. Dr. Richmond, I've really enjoyed our time together. Thank you for being my guest today. The time has flown by.
Yes, thank you so much, and I appreciate you sharing this time with me and letting me come on, and that's it. So have a wonderful day, and thank you to your audience, and I hope we can do it again.
Me too. We can definitely plan it again in 2018. It'd be great.
For sure.
Awesome.
Take care.
Okay,
yes.
Take care as well, Dr. Richmond.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That concludes my show today with Dr. Richmond of richmondcare.com, psychotherapist in Los Angeles, California. Please join me next week with another guest, and I hope you have a great week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only.